Hello and welcome to recording number 9 of Gary Gygax's Sea of Death, an annotated reading. Today is September 9th, 2021. We've just had Gord, who's making his way to the south to try to cross over at Gastor, down in what is called Yol in this book. So Gygax has run across several Paynim men who have adopted him into the tribe to try to extort gifts out of him. But Gord has taken a rather hard line with them. So, you know, no gifts for them from Gord. So I'm going to restart right here. It is page 99 and paragraph 3. Morning brought with it a heavy patchy fog. Gord could make out large features of the landscape, but details were not visible from more than a few hundred yards away. He realized that his special sight did not give him any advantage in this sort of condition, and this worried him, but only briefly. After the group had readied for the day's travel, Ephlam suddenly pointed into the distance and began to shout a high yipping call. The other two Akhmani warriors took up this cry, and Gord demanded to know what was the matter. "Nothing is the matter, Farzul," said Ephlam, in a vaguely condescending tone. "That line of riders there, see, that is the rest of our group. Soon the other warriors of our tribe will greet you, and we can all ride to ravage the lands of the Yolite dogs." The nomads mounted and kicked their mounts into a gallop, not bothering to see if their new brother was following, intent on going to meet their fellow Akhmani raiders. Okusin, the smallest of the three, and the one riding the swiftest horse, took the lead, opening a gap of a few dozen yards between himself and the other two. Gord followed their lead, but kept Windeater to a canter, allowing the nomad warriors to stay ahead. A minute later, he still could not figure out how many men were approaching through the fog, because they seemed to be riding in close quarters. Then Hookison's yipping cries turned to another sort of sound, a braying shout, and he reined in his steed. "Hurry, Farzul," Ephlam called over his shoulder. "Those are the curs of Yol before us." As he spoke, he and his comrades slowed their movement to a trot. Hookison had wheeled his horse and was almost back with the rest. Break. So, we can say here, just a little note about the Paynim, who are called the, Akhmani Raiders. They're the Paynim as we know them. And so we know that they call to each other in the distance, their yipping cry to recognize each other. And that's just a little tidbit that we can take on to our campaigns, or a little lore to add to very little that we know about the Paynims. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 100. Second paragraph. Oh, I'm sorry. Third paragraph. "What made you so sure that these would be your men?" Gord said as he came up near the nomads. "See the two low ridges on the horizon," Ephlam said, pointing with his head as he fumbled free a small bow from its case on his steed's flank. "The space between them marks a place of rendezvous for the Okami warriors. The disease-ridden Yolites must have accidentally come through there." "What now?" the young adventurer asked. The question was voiced in an offhand tone, but as he spoke it, Gord pulled his sling from his belt and reached into his pouch for a stone. Effin looked resigned as he knocked a broad-headed arrow. "We stand and shoot until they are upon us. Then we fight." And so saying, he released the shaft at the charging Yolites. Gord saw that the other two Akhmani had done likewise, so he spun his sling and sent a stone flying forth. A pair of the foemen fell from arrows, and a second later, Ford's stone hit a horse. The steed stumbled and sent its rider tumbling to be trampled beneath the hooves of the other animals. "Good shot, Farzul," Ephlum cried. "Give those dogs another such kiss." There was no time for that, Gord knew. The Achmani were drawing back their next arrows, but it would take him too long to reload his sling. Gord tucked away that weapon and drew his light lance from its leather sleeve just as another Yolite went down, with an Achmani arrow in his chest. Crouched low, his lance aimed, Gord coaxed Windeater into a trot, heading toward the Yolites. The trot changed to a canter, and was just opening into a full gallop when he was all but closed with the enemy. From this close distance, Gore could see that he and the Achmani were up against. The Yola warriors were armed with scimitars, and many also carried lances similar to the one that Gord plied. They had bow cases, too, and as he approached the charging line of enemy warriors, Gord supposed they either disdained using missiles against so numerically inferior a foe, or else didn't wish to risk wasting arrows. Shooting from a galloping horse was difficult, and few could perform such a feat with accuracy, even in clear air. In this fog, it would have been all but impossible to hit a solitary target. There were about a score of the Yoli nomads still, 5-1 against them, Gord estimated. And now they had fanned out, apparently trying to surround the four of them. Gord was glad to see that they held their positions in this spread-out formation, because that meant he would only have to contend with two or three of the enemy at one time. Yol, 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 that sound washed over Gord as he maneuvered to keep the Yolites from getting at his back. He chose a target at the same time the target chose him. And a warrior, voicing this strange chant at the top of his lungs, lowered his lance and thundered toward Gord. As they closed, Gord swayed quickly in his high saddle to avoid the wavy-bladed lance that threatened to pierce his chest. The point of his own lance took the Yolite in the shoulder, a poor hit. He had been aiming at the heart, but his movement to avoid the foe's weapon had spoiled his own attack. Nevertheless, Gord's hit was sufficient to dismount the Yolai warrior, and then Gord was past the enemy, and pivoting Windeater to charge again. Just before he turned back toward the fray, Gord thought he detected another group of riders approaching in the mist, and he instantly feared the worst. If the Yolites they were now engaged with only comprised an advanced group, and he and his comrades were surely doomed. Gord silently resolved to make one or more pass through the enemy ranks and do what he could, but then he would turn from the battle and drive Windeater as hard as he could away from this futile cause. Great. All right, so there is a little question here. There's been a lot of talk about correspondence between Earth countries' cultures and Earth-based inspirations, like Ket being like the medieval or like the Ottomans. Did Gygax leave any notes writing about his exact inspirations, like the Bedouins for the Paynims? Not that I've come across. Now, I do know that Gygax framed, the Greyhawk campaign, but he only had some notes with it, and then it was passed over. Now, the crew that took it up, they obviously, to my mind, made a mistake about the rovers, because Gygax refers to them as Ottoman, their leader, which is a Cossack leader, and several other things lead them to be like horse nomads of Eastern Europe. And that is something that most people are really unaware of, and most Americans would immediately think of American Indians as horse nomads. But But really, American Indian were not horse nomads till after the Spanish invasion, after Cortez. And it took a while for those horses to sift into North America. And so they really only have a few hundred years of horse nomadic life, whereas Eastern European horse nomads go back to the time of Caesar and before. So, you know, it's really a case of just not being familiar with that, with certain things in the cultures. Now, I'm assuming that there must have been a lot of things that were either so obvious or else Gygax may have made notes. I'd love to see the notations, the Gygax's original draft. Because obviously, Paran Land is Switzerland. The tiger and wolf nomads are Mongols and Turks, or Mongols and Magyars, or but they're definitely the you know, the east of the Ural kind of horse nomads. Blackmore is dropped in because, you know, they wanted to add it for Arnonson's editions. And then various, you go state by state and you get Ket and Bissell, I think of his medieval Ottomans and medieval Magyars, because they, not only were they in, you know, direct contact, but there was continuous warfare between them for a very long time, till the Ottomans around the 1500s had conquered all of, driven the king out of Budapest, and had conquered all the way up to Vienna. Now, I think there's like, you know, there's things that are obvious. The Olmans are definitely Aztec, but they are kind of shoved in after incorporating Module C1, which had originally been a generic Aztec-style tournament module. And then, so we're looking at here, and very obviously, you're going to have to pick and choose what kind of Middle Eastern or so, because the Baklunish definitely, you know, are Middle Eastern from the folio on. So you really have to look at it and say, from what we know, what are these, what kind of cultures inspired them? And across the Flaness, it is, honestly, there is so much European, you know, inspiration in all of these things. The Sul Imperium is very like the Roman Empire. You know, we get Geoff, which is very Welsh. You know, so we can go country by country. There's, you know, like some disagreement. Like, I think Furiundi is more like medieval France. I think, you know, we have just country by country. There isn't like a direct one-to-one. And in this Baklunish, we don't really have too many choices. I mean, the Paynim, they're very Bedouin. And the more established countries, I think Ekbar is very Persian Empire. I think Zeif, to me, is very Egyptian. But it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. So here we're looking for Gygax's own... we get these hints on with Gygax's very own lore here coming out of these books. And then we obviously see that Ket is a very much a mixed country, and a gateway to the east, which would have been like Turkey as a gateway from the Middle East to the to Europe. So, I mean, I think each one of us has our own favorites for using a historical background. Now, you don't have to, but Gygax, I think, obviously did use real-world earthly cultures as a background. And I would say, you know, like we're looking at different styles of Middle Eastern cultures here. The Tuzmidi only being seasonal nomads, the Paynims being more continual nomads, perennial, they're it all year, like the tiger nomads. So I think we're really getting here, you know, examples of the intermixtures of the real, you know, the real Middle Eastern cultures. But but with the original question, I've never seen the notes, and I'd really love to. I'd like to see if he ever did say directly to them, this is like this, and, you know, this culture is like that culture. All right, so we get a little more now about the Yolites. We get their yell, that yol, yol, yol. You know, it's a little thing to add. Again, just like the Hanum here are doing the same thing. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 102 and the second paragraph. Ord lowered his lance again and charged toward a warrior who's trying to cut down Hookison from the flank, hitting the orange and red garbed nomad full in the side. The blow broke the shaft of Gord's lance, but the young adventurer used the splintered piece of wood to confuse another attacker, hurling it into the fellow's face. Ord drew his short-bladed sword and prepared to take on one or warriors stood between him and his escape. Just as he began his charge, he heard from behind the sound of pounding hooves and more loud shouts. The second group of men was closing on them, but this time the war cry was different. Ye, 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 Akhmani! Into the suddenly confused ranks of the Yoli rode the 24 and more warriors of the band that Ephlum and his men had been expecting. Green and gray striped cloaks intermixed with the flame-colored and reddish-pink checks that adorned the Yoli warriors' clothing. All right, break. So, again, we're getting like this consistency of clothing. So of these, you know, Paynim, they're wearing green and gray. And the flame color and reddish pink checks are the color of the Yoli, it seems. So we're getting a little bit more campaign information there. And I always like to make note of even these small things. We have another war cry of the Yee-Yee-Yee Akhmani. All right. I'm going to restart. It's the last paragraph on page 102. Although surprised at the arrival of these additional enemies, the Yolites were neither discouraged nor intimidated. They stopped their casual approach to the combat and fought more fiercely now that the odds had suddenly shifted against them, roughly 2-1 in favor of the Akhmani. Gord figured. He exchanged cuts with one rider, then the press separated them, and the young adventurer was engaged with a new opponent. After each man encountered several blows, Gord managed to slip under the horse Yoli's small shield, and his short sword pierced the swarthy nomad's heart. All right, great. Now, Gord's, you know, a very high-level thief, very strong, so it could be that this is a stronger individual he's running against rather than the kind that can be felled very quickly. So here, we're seeing, you know, like the combat going. And one of the things that is mentioned is the press. Now, in both in mounted combat and in melee combat, where there's a very thick, almost shoulder-to-shoulder kind of combat going on, there is a force coming from your own side, the press of the numbers behind you and to the sides, so that normally in these kinds of combats, you get a few cuts and blocks against your enemy, and then he's pushed, and another one is pushed to face you. And it's usually this continual grinding process where, you know, you face one man, and maybe you're lucky to get one or two strikes at him, but then another is pushed in his place. And even in the most dense combat I've seen in D&D, that aspect of the combat is almost always overlooked, that regardless of your desire to stand and face your foe, the pressure from your own side if you're really in a dense melee or you're among a bunch of fighting horses, you are not still. You are being moved, and there's this kind of movement that is continuous. So, you know, if you ever want to run a melee combat or masked horsesmen against each other, it's really something to think about, that your characters are not going to be able to really engage in a like a heroic single man-to-man combat. Let me check something. All right, okay. All right, I am going to restart. It is page 103, second paragraph. All of the Akhmani were not faring as well as Gord, however. The Yolites had regrouped and were cutting and stabbing furiously. The young adventurer had a moment to wonder what would happen if the fray continued, but then the tide seemed to turn against the Yolai warriors, and a half dozen of them reeled and fell in as many seconds. As this occurred, Gord heard yet more battle cries in the distance, followed by screams that came from the opposite end of the battleground, the area closest to this new group of attackers. He turned to look in that direction and saw that the screams were coming from Akhmani warriors being felled by streaking darts of glowing light. Knowing magical missiles when he saw them, Gord instantly flattened himself along Wind Eater's back. Kneeing the stallion into a trot, he headed away from the approaching knot of newcomers. A fast glance backward told him that a new group contained a handful of Yolites and a larger number of men dressed in unidentifiable but non-Yoli garb. Gord thought he saw a dwarf with these new attackers, but he wasn't certain, and there was now no time now to study the onrushing band. Again, the young adventurer urged Wind Eater, this time with both booted heels. The small stallion broke into a run. In moments, the swift courser had carried him away from the melee, heading west. Gord peered over his shoulder. He saw a few striped cloaks fluttering behind fleeing riders. These would be the surviving Akhmani, spreading out from the enemies in all directions. Break. So, right here, it sounds like he's encountered Obmi's group. If I'm correct, if Obmi is still in dwarven appearance, at this point, I'm not quite sure. Could that might even appear as Eklavdra, or at least Eklavdra's clone, who is trying to distract. So, I think it's one of the contestants or the other. And in that case, Gord by himself, with only these, fairly low-level nomads as his support, doesn't look like he's in a good position to take on the whole group. Remember, they're allowed 9 powerful followers, so that could be a very deadly encounter for Gord. All right, I am going to restart page 103 and the final paragraph. Wind Eater topped a low rise and pounded down the reverse slope. The young adventurer turned his mount's head slowly toward the left, so that they were now galloping southwest. Gord knew that for a time at least, possible pursuers would be unable to see him, and he meant to stay totally out of sight. If he could. In the direction he was riding, the ground fell away to form a long depression between swales of land to either side. Once in the depression, Gord knew that the enemy riders would be unable to see him. Whether the weapon was bow or spell, he had no wish to be a target. Wind Eater ran on without faltering. They covered fully 2 leagues and had long since outrun the fog before Gord called soothing words to the gallant animal and pulled gently on the reins. The horse fell into an easy canter, and Gord allowed him to remain at that pace. When it seemed likely that he had thrown off any who might have been following, Gord brought Wind Eater to a halt, dismounted, and quickly unsaddled the horse. Before he could begin wiping the steed's flanks of the coat of sweat, Windeater whinnied with pleasure and began rolling in the long grass. "Well, my friend," Gord said to the stallion, "I appreciate you doing that job for yourself, but don't take too long at it." As if he had understood the young man's words, Windeater stopped and got to his feet with a lunging motion. The stallion began to crop grass, tearing mouthfuls of the stuff as quickly as he could. Gord left Windeater busy thus and scrambled up the bank to his right. It was high enough to allow the young adventurer to see what lay ahead of him to the west, and back from where he had come too. There was nothing of interest ahead, but far to the east, Gord saw a line of mounted men moving toward him at a trot, moving along the route he had been taking. "Shit," he murmured disgustedly under his breath. The Yolai seemed determined to dog him. Even though he was a few miles ahead of them, they were apparently following Windeater's tracks, and as long as they chose to do that, there was no way Gord could avoid them. Wondering why they would bother to pursue a single fugitive from a chance encounter, Gord slid back down the slope and put the blanket and saddle back on the stallion. "Oh, Windeater, let's move on. You don't want to belong to some Yolai master, do you?" The horse snorted and shook his head. Gord laughed and sent the stallion toward the west, going at a slow trot to match the speed of those who followed. For 2 days and one night, his pursuers kept on his trail. Gord was able to stop at night to allow Windeater to rest, and he even got a little sleep himself when it became apparent that the party behind him had also stopped for the night. On the second night, Gord decided to take matters into his own hands, so to speak. He left Windeater grazing contentedly, loosely tethered to a sturdy bit of scrub brush. After getting well away from the horse, Gord shifted from human to panther, using that form to travel back along his route. About 3 miles to the east, he came upon the camp of the group that was pursuing him. Three guards stood on duty, while about 10 other men slept. From where he crouched, Gord the panther thought that at least one of the sentries was a demi-human with night vision, for his eyes reflected the firelight when he peered back toward the camp. Gord was careful to stay as far away from that guard as possible. As he slunk around the perimeter of the encampment in the form of a great cat, he managed to get close enough to inspect the equipment of some of the sleepers. Not all of those whom he viewed thus had armor and weapons laid carefully nearby. This meant that there were probably at least a pair of spell workers in the pursuing party. That was all he could learn, so he departed as silently as he had come. The young adventurer was disappointed. At best, he had hoped to be able to get among the horses and chase them off, leaving the enemy afoot. That would have meant the end of their pursuit, for finding their mounts would have taken them at least a full day, if indeed they ever found all of the horses. Unfortunately, the night-seeing sentry happened to be posted at the place where the horses were tethered, so this spoiled his plan. At worst, Gord had decided he would attack the group and try to reduce it in number, but he was deterred from his plan by his discovery that the group contained magic users or clerical spellcasters, or both. Gord was frustrated but undaunted. If he could not use easy means to rid himself of this unwanted group of followers, then he would have to rely upon Windeater's ability and simply outdistance them. Solving the problem in this way would be harder and take longer, but Gord was confident that the pursuit would eventually cease. Even the best trackers would lose his trail when distance was sufficient to enable him to use terrain, weather, and movement of herd animals to cover his tracks. All right, break. So, quite a lot going on right there. But one of the key things that I'm reading here is that, and it seems small, but I think it's an important thing, that Gord is mentioning tracks of herd animals. Now, nomads normally live upon herd animals. So it looks like the Yoli, and maybe also, or at very least, the Paynims, that they are the kind living off of herds. Now, that would also imply, and the talk about the wild grass that Windeater is eating, that this is not exactly a wasteland. There's a requirement for a sustainable amount of food and also a sustainable amount of water. So there have to be, in this area, streams, oases, the kind of wild grass that Windeater is eating, but enough to support the herds, and the herds support the nomads. So even from a very small comment, there's indications that go far beyond it. For example, if they were herding sheep, sheep are defenseless. So it would have to mean that area is heavily protected from enemies, from raiders, from monsters, from any kind of predator. So one thing really links with another right there. So if they're living on herds, it changes the aspect of the desert. This is not a sea of dust. This is some survivable nomadic area. Not necessarily a sandy area, but perhaps just, the kind of plains that you see out in the east of Europe, where there are long plains that are wonderful for herds of cattle and, horses, as well as, herds generally of any kind of herd animal that's living off that kind of terrain. All right. I'm going to restart. It's page 106 and the third paragraph. As if the elements favored him, the morning sky dawned gloomy, and intermittent light rain showers began shortly after sunrise. While Gord dozed in the saddle, Windeater trotted along, seeming to enjoy the dark and foul weather as much as he liked sunny days. Suddenly a clap of thunder brought the young rider to wakefulness. The grass around him was tossing like wind-whipped water. Huge, flat-topped clouds loomed in front of him, black and ominous, their interiors illuminated by great flashes of lightning. Windeater did not mind the gentle rain, but thunder and lightning were another matter. The horse's eyes grew huge and wild, showing white, and his nostrils became dilated. Gord patted his neck and spoke soothingly to the stallion, but the streaking lightning and booming thunder undid his work as quickly as the young thief did it. Then the wind increased, rain sheeted down, and the crack and bang of the great storm hammered so at the senses that Windeater became unmanageable. Gord swung the animal's head toward the south, the only direction where the fury of the weather seemed less, and gave the courser his head. Windeater ran, and Gord held on for all he was worth. After a time, the ground beneath Windeater's hooves became harder and more slippery. This rocky landscape made traveling difficult, but Gord let the horse pick his way through the terrain. Instead of trying to search for a safer route, he knew that somewhere in this area would likely be a cave or projection where man and horse could find a dry and safe haven, and they did indeed find a large overhang, which provided the two with a relatively dry and comfortable place to wait out the storm. After unsaddling Windeater, Gord hobbled the exhausted stallion and fed him a handful of grain. Then the young adventurer stretched out on the hard stone and instantly fell asleep. When Gord awoke, it was dawn, and he was stiff, sore, and miserably damp, but at the same time heartened by the fact that it would be impossible for his pursuers to continue to track him through the rain and over the rock. Windeater seemed to have recovered from his harrowing experience. Sometime during the night, when the rain had let up, the animal had moved out of the sheltered spot. He was now 100 feet distance, working on eating the bits of vegetation that cropped up here and there among the stony ground and precipitous walls of rock around them. The storm still lingered, for Gord could see occasional lightning far to the north. Southward, the sky was clouded but undisturbed. To his left, Gord saw a dark line of the sort that could only indicate mountains, while to the west, deep clouds bumped the plain that showed that the storm traveled southwest. "Windeater, we must ride south between the storm and the mountains," he said to the stallion as he placed a blanket and saddle upon the horse's strong back. "At least we will no longer be troubled by any hounds of Yol dogging us." Break. That's the end of chapter 6. There's some good ideas about horses in here. Like Gord's first, after that run, the first thing he does is he unsaddles and starts wiping down Windeater. Horses, are not indestructible, and you can easily injure their legs or, kill them from, pushing them, riding at a fast pace. So normally, galloping like that, as fast as you can, is only done in sprints. It is not done as a steady pace. In fact, you normally would take horses and, you would walk them. You would first slow them down and then take them to a slow pace. Then you'd get off and lead them for a while. It's not ride. You need to give the horses a break. And I'm glad to see that Gygax notices that. He notes the danger of running over the rock. And Gord, Gord's little exploration as the cat, he's very powerful, but he recognizes the dangers. He is worried about magic users because they have unpredictable spells that can paralyze him, do injuries that he wouldn't be able to get in a straight-up fight normally. And also, put him to sleep, paralyze him, different things like that. So magic user, in its way, is much more dangerous than a swordsman, especially to Gord, who knows how to hold himself in a sword fight. All right. I'm going to begin at chapter 7. It's page 108, first paragraph. Everywhere the land was parched. It wasn't all sandy desert, or even a combination of sand and rock. There were patches of such ground aplenty, but more frequently the land was cracked earth dotted with skeletal plants. There were cacti and stunted trees, too, growing in depressions and along steep-sided gullies. "I guess it does rain here sometimes," Gord said, patting the horse's neck as he peered round at the waste. "I'm glad you're a hardy one, Windeater, or else we would be in desperate straits." The stallion moved on, ears twitching to indicate he heard his master's words, but he had interest only in where his hooves were placed. They had been traveling across the barrens for 2 days. Windeater had been able to find sufficient forage, but didn't like the cracked ground. Sand and rock troubled the stallion not at all. In fact, the courser moved with ease through the loose grains of such stuff and trotted easily on hard sheets of bare rock. However, broken and powdery dirt, prickly succulents, and potholes made the courser uneasy, and as he paced through such terrain, he paid attention mainly to his footing. The ground became very rough. Gord dismounted and walked his mount then, not wanting to risk a fall or a broken leg. Clambering down a steep bank, they found themselves in a boulder-strewn wash that apparently served as the bed of a swift watercourse at times. The relatively smooth and level terrain here offered a fairly sure and easy means of travel, so Gord and the stallion shifted their path from south to southwest. following its course. At mid-morning, they rounded a sharp bend, and Gord's eyes lit up in the same instant that Wind Eater's nostrils flared. "Look, Wind Eater," Gord boomed. "Water at last." In a moment, both man and horse were drinking from a deep pool off to one side of the dry wash, a place where the flood that came periodically sweeping along the wash had deposited some of its content. It was a well-used water hole, judging from the signs of hoof and paw imprinted round it. As thirsty as the two travelers were, neither man nor horse cared. After checking quickly to see if any predatory animals lurked nearby, Gord dismounted, dropped to his knees, and began splashing and drinking. Wind Eater lowered his head and sucked up great gulps of the precious liquid, even as his master did likewise. "If you move, Bayouin dog, you are dead." Gord froze, lifting his head imperceptibly. The young adventurer could just see the shadows that indicated men behind him, advancing as they came down the slope of the wash. A horse jerked his head up and snorted wildly at the sound of the unfamiliar voice. Then came a clatter as rocks were dislodged by approaching feet, and at that Wind Eater snorted again and bolted, trotting away on down the dry wash. "Kodon, Vakta!" cried out the same voice that had threatened Gord. "Stop that horse. He's worth more than this one in the great bazaar." A short distance ahead, Gord saw a couple of men riding camels appear over the edge of the wash and head down into the depression, trying to intercept the runaway horse. In the bit of confusion this incident caused, Gord decided to take a chance. With one smooth move, he rolled to his right, gained his feet, and started to dart away along the same route Wind Eater had taken. But before he could take more than a couple of steps, a lasso circled his upper arms and drew them tight to his sides, stopping him in his tracks. A second later, another lariat tightened round his neck. The point of the weapon touched the small of his back. At the same time, Gord stood stock still. He was captured, and there was no use attempting anything now to compound the peril. The weapon at his back was taken away, and two of his attackers mounted on camels came round to his front, and he glared at them as they examined him. "This is no Baburi, even though he is dressed like one. See his eyes. Had he different hair, he might be one of our own people." Gord looked from one speaker to the other. Both men were swathed in buff-colored garments, turbaned and veiled, too. All he could see of them were patches of dark skin where their hands held weapons, and gray eyes through the slits in their veils. "Who are you?" one of the voices demanded. The rope that circled his neck was pulled tighter by one of the men still behind him, and the young man had to shake his head a little to enable his constricted throat to get words out. "I am a peaceful traveler from the north." "Liar," boomed the questioner. At the same time, the other man confronting Gord brought the tip of a lance to within inches of his stomach. "Only bandits and rogues come from the north. Where is the rest of your party?" "I'm alone," Gord said. Liar still, the one holding the lance against his belly, said, as they pushed the point forward a little to make his statement show how he felt about falsehoods. "You are a scout for the band of Yoli dogs who ride but a little distance behind." The statement made Gord's blood run cold. Could his old pursuers still be on his trail? If so, and if they were really that close, then all of them, camel riders and Gord alike, would soon be dead. "Those Yoli are enemies who seek my death," the young man said as forcefully as he dared. "When we take them, Snake Tongue, we will make all of you speak truth." "Have a care, warrior," Gord shot back. "There are workers of spells among those after me." "Let's be done with this one now, Yahood. I think he is a renegade who leads our enemies to our waterholes and oases. The lance-bearer demurred. Perhaps, Haradun, but I am not so sure. See that he is bound and guarded. Then this man, apparently the leader of the group, looked past Gord and gave another order. Bokair, take your men and spy out the Oli. Aye, Yahud, Bokair replied from behind Gord. What shall I do when I come to the enemy? Use your eyes, think, then act. You're my right hand, said the one called Yahud. Bokair turned his mount around, gestured to a small group of nomads, and all of them headed back in the direction from which Gord had come. Gord was half-led, half-dragged to a sheltered spot 100 yards away, a place where the curve of the gully and an outcropping of rock hid him and his captors from view. The nomads remaining with him, 4 in number, stripped him of all his weapons and gear, leaving him with nothing but his simple clothing, and trussed him with coils of rope so that he could barely move. 2 took up positions as sentries nearby, while the other pair stayed next to Gord, their long, straight swords ready to cut him down if he tried to get free. Shortly after Gord was bound, he heard the sound of approaching riders, followed by telltale snorts that could only mean one thing: Windeater had been captured. The beast is fast and ornery too, said one man to the others, but we finally got a noose around him. Quite a prize, is he not? Gord was saddened that Windeater had not escaped. In fact, he felt worse about that than he did about his own plight. The shade disappeared as the sun rose to its zenith. Gord sweated and wondered what was going to happen. Right now, he was as good as dead any time the men who held him chose to kill him. He considered, then dismissed, trying to change to panther form. That would take time, and he doubted that he would be invulnerable to their weapons during the transition, even if none of the warriors bore magical blades. The young adventurer waited and watched for an opportunity as patiently as he could, but his guards never took their eyes from him. After nearly 2 hours more, he heard the soft sounds of camels coming down the stream bed, and then conversation that took place right outside where he was being held. What did you learn, Bokair? This one spoke truth, Yahud. The Yoli were after him, and with them were workers of spells. So, I parleyed with the fools. When I told them we had captured a stranger garbed in Alberbi dress, they asked for his surrender. They offered me silver for him, threatening to slay us and take him by force otherwise. Well, you are not dead. Where are the Yoli? Bokair laughed derisively. They're as stupid as all the rest of the Bakluni, my sheikh. When I signaled for my warriors to allow themselves to be seen, the Yoli dogs seemed impressed. The warriors made themselves seem 100, and their crossbows were in evidence. At such range and with so much cover, the outland spellcasters with Yoli would be of little use once the fighting began. What did the dogs offer then? Yahud asked, heavy contempt for the Yoli evident in his question. The leader of the group was one of the foreign spell workers. He and the chief warrior of the Yoli conferred for a time, and then the dung-eating Yoli actually told me that through the kindness of his mighty captain's heart, they would spare us if we promised to slay the prisoner we held. So, I laughed at the statement, asking why the interlopers thought we would spare them. The Aradan can kill whomever we wish, as we wish, I said. Then the Yoli babbled to their pale-skinned leader, and we began to bargain. Break. So we finally get to hear who these are. Now, in regards to the campaign, I'm not quite sure, but they're the Aradan. And so we know that they're not all. Gord seems to have passed south beyond y'all, now into the the barren area between Ol and the Sea of Dust. And here, these particular nomads, they seem a very large, strong force. Now we have Gord captured. And that is, you know, it's a matter of the use of the lariat. And Gord was surprised, taken from behind. It's still, you know, it's still questionable, you know, what kind of, if you're looking at gameplay, this is a very odd situation. It's, I'm not sure how the lariat and the capture rules would work at this point, or what if Gygax is dropping away from, now that he's not part of TSR, is he getting away from that rule system, working on the Dangerous Journeys rule system, or simply writing the story at this point and avoiding really gameplay? Because it is a very odd situation here. Gord is captured. So if we were looking this in game mechanics, there'd have to be, you know, there's a number of factors that do lead up to him, but he's so high level. It seems very strange to me that they were able to sneak up on him. But and then the capture, and I'm not sure how mechanically, game mechanically, you would work that out using the systems of first edition. All right. I'm going to restart. We have about 9 minutes left, and hopefully get a little further into this. We are on page 113, and it is the fourth paragraph. From your tone, Boker, I would guess that the Yoli were as easy as always, Yahud said mirthfully. In the end, Sheikh, they gave over 100 silver pieces, these 2 good horses, and a necklace of gold. In exchange, we allowed them to ride back the way they had come, unmolested. The silver is to assure that our guest dies, he finished. You gave your word, Yahud asked the man incredulously. That he would surely die? Yes, Sheikh, that I did. But when he would die, that I did not say at all. He will fetch our tribe yet more silver in the slave market, our Carnouche. Slaves sold there die quickly anyway. At least those who go to the mines of Zondabad do. One such as this one, small but well-muscled, will surely be bought by the Kizam's agents for just such work. All right, break. So we've got the market, our Carnouche. We have mines of Zondabad, and we have Kizam, who is either the name of a person or it's a title of the one running the mine. So that, you know, I'm not quite sure what society we're talking about right here. We know they're called the Aradin, and what society Carnouche is. All right. I'm going to restart. It's page 113, and we're on the second paragraph to the end. Well done, Bokir. Make sure the Oli are carefully watched, for I trust them not. Join us as soon as you can. We will ride south to Carnouche. After his captors freed him enough so that he could ride, Gord was unceremoniously placed atop a camel. Boker and a small band of warriors headed north, and the remaining nomads with Gord went in the opposite direction under the leadership of the one called Yahud. After they had ridden about 2 miles, they met up with the main body of the nomad force, so that the group traveling south now numbered about 100 camel riders. Besides the camels the men rode, there were quite a few other hump beasts bearing equipment. And supplies. With these pack camels were his own horse, and the 2 gained from the Yoli, and 6 less desirable animals, probably either wild horses taken by the nomads, or else prizes from some raid. Gord saw no other prisoners, so he supposed that the small horses were wild ones. His guards still numbered 4, even though Gord was virtually helpless. precariously perched atop a camel that was being led by one guard, flanked by two others, and covered from the ear by yet another of the nomads. These Aradan, as they called themselves, were both thorough and cautious. Even though they had confiscated everything from Gord, they were still taking no chances that he would escape, or that they might be forced to kill him if he made such an attempt. Apparently Gord thought he had enough value to the Aradan that they strongly desired to keep him alive and in their possession until they reached the slave market. But they did not know just what resources he still had at his command, both natural and not so natural. He felt sure that he could get out of his bonds in moments, if he ever got the chance. In addition, he had the power to see at night, an ability first bestowed upon him by his cat's eye ring, but something that his long contact with the ring now enabled him to call upon even when he was not wearing it. He might be helpless at the moment, but he was certainly not beyond hope. Although he was treated roughly by his captors, and riding a camel proved to be sheer torture for him at first, Gord was given food and water whenever the Aradan ate and drank. After a couple of days, the young adventurer became fairly accustomed to his strange mount, and the pain of his sore muscles lessened enough so that Gord was able to actually pay attention to his surroundings as he rode. The land they passed over was similar to that which he and Windeater had encountered before. All right, I'm going to break here. We're getting pretty close to the end. And I wanted to make a few comments. We're getting quite a bit of information. People at Carnoush practice slavery. The Rodden at least sell slaves if they don't own it themselves. So, you know, we're seeing the kind of society it is. Now, I have a really, you know, again, I think Gygax, there is no reason why Gygax cannot have Gord escape during the night. I mean, the very first night he's captive, he could turn into a house cat, if not naturally slip his bonds from being a thief of extreme level. He could easily turn into a house cat. He could leave the camp. He could turn into a panther, which is a werepanther that cannot be affected by non-magical weapons. Depending on, you know, this does not sound like a group that is going to have maybe even magical weapons. Gord could easily escape. I think he even is in a position, if not to regain his possessions and weapons, unless they're on the way back too, I think he could easily secure Windeater drive off. Or if he couldn't drive off, he could escape and follow these men and pick them off. So unless there's like 100 of them, I know they mentioned 100, I can't see any of them being able to stop Gord in his panther form. I really wish I had we really do need a translator here for New Infinity's Greyhawk and the regular Greyhawk campaign, because I'm very interested to find out these two cultures here. Obviously, the nomads are one culture, and they could be Paynim, because they are against the Yoli. In a sense, they don't quite seem like Paynim to me. They're not wearing the green and gray. They're wearing, I believe, an all dusky kind of color. They seem like they're perhaps a different culture. And then the people at Carnoush, who are actually in a city, they're definitely not a nomadic culture. So we've got two cultures introduced right here, the Aradan and the people of Carnoush. And a mine, which might be part of the same society run by somebody named Kazim. So, as we get on into the story tomorrow, maybe we can work out more. Now, today, Chris wasn't able to join us. So unfortunately, a lot of this, you know, Chris is great at pulling up maps and doing this and spotting questions and spotting things within the books, and he is heartily missed. So maybe tomorrow we can pull up some stuff. All right, 7 o'clock, and I'm going to be ending for the night. And hopefully won't forget. See you, Si. I don't know if Jim's back, but see you, Jim, if you're listening. And I'll try to do this right this time and not leave the recording going.